Good evening. Thank you for joining Disability and Progress, where we bring you insights into ideas about and discussions on disability topics. My name is Sam. I'm the host of this show. Charlene Dahl is my research team. Matt Finkel is the engineer for this episode, and thanks to him for doing so. My name is Sam. I'm the host of this show. If you want to be on my email list, you may email me at disabilityandprogress@samjasmine.com. Many a people have been drug on when they sent me an email. So, if you want to speak your mind or have a topic aired, you should do so. Tonight, we are speaking with Leah Bauman-Smith. Leah is talking to us tonight about the company Mad Hatter Wellness. And Mad Hatter Wellness provides sexual education for people with all abilities. Some discussions that may be discussed on this episode could be sensitive content that for younger viewers. So be aware of that. Thank you for joining us. Leah,
thank you so much.
Yes. Leah, can you tell me, start out by telling me, who is Mad Hatter Wellness and how did the company get its start?
Yeah, for sure. So Mad Hatter Wellness is a small company based out of St. Paul, Minnesota. Mm-hmm. There are three of us that work full-time, and then we have a few other people that kind of come and help us out with assisting our classes or, with just kind of general support. Mad Hatter started about, I think, 7 or 8 years ago. A woman by the name of Katie Thune started Mad Hatter Wellness. She was a special education teacher in St. Paul Public Schools, and she left there to kind of start a company that really focused on health and wellness for people with disabilities. And she found that sexuality education kind of kept coming up as one of the themes and one of the needs that she was seeing within her programming. So as of right now, we have two programs. So one is called Power V, which is a program that focuses kind of on that middle school age young people and focusing on kind of empowering skills. And we talk about puberty and healthy behaviors and just kind of a nice way to help out people kind of going through that transitional phase of being in middle school. And then our other program and classes and stuff that we offer is called Sexuality for All Abilities, which is a published curriculum that a number of schools around the state use and a few around the country. And that is a curriculum for sexuality education for people of all abilities. It was created kind of with people with intellectual and cognitive and developmental delays in mind when we created it. And we also work with people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, kind of help us create that curriculum. And but I've been teaching it for a few years now, and it definitely, it works well with everyone. People with all abilities can really benefit from sexuality education.
Well, fortunately or unfortunately for me, I remember my middle school years well, junior high. And my feelings of junior high are people become a little bit subhuman then, so I think they need all the help they can get.
Yeah, it's a rough, puberty is rough, man.
Yes it is. So how did you decide that you were going to get involved doing something like this?
Yeah, so my background is in special education. I was a special education teacher for about 13 or 14 years. And about 10 years ago, I was super lucky and got to participate in a class or a series of classes through a program called The Birds and the Bees, which was offered
that's great.
Yeah, right? Through the University of Minnesota. And I think it was only around, it was like a grant-funded program, so it was only around for a couple years. But it was to get licensed teachers certified in sexuality education. And I kind of just like on a whim was like, oh yeah, I want to do that. That sounds great. So I did that program. And then, yeah, just kind of on my own was just started teaching sex ed to special education. I kind of got resources from the Birds and the Bees program. There's a few other, there's a program called Flash that does sex ed for people in special education, but there weren't a lot of materials or curriculum or information for me. And so a colleague of mine actually sent me like a link to Katie's work in Mad Hatter Wellness. And I went to a training of hers maybe 3 years ago now. And during the presentation, she was like, you know, I really want to hire more people, but not a lot of people have kind of a background in both sexuality education and special education. And I was like, oh my goodness, like I found my people. And so after the training, I emailed her and I was like, you want to hire me? Like, I wasn't even like, hey, I'm interested. Like, I just like sent her an email being like, you want me to work for you? And then we met for coffee and talked for 4 hours, and now I work for her. And it's so fun.
So what ages and I guess disabilities you teach, I mean, what did you have in your special ed class when you were working with them?
Yeah, so I primarily worked with high school age students. I love working with teens. They're a super fun age of humans. And so, yeah, my background is definitely in work with high school students. Now we do, we actually teach a really wide range of ages. We taught a class this fall that included preschool students where we talked about just kind of the idea of like, my body belongs to me. I get to decide who touches it when and where, just kind of more of those like basic, like here are your body parts. This is what they're called. This is what they do. All the way up through, we have groups that we work with who are older adults, and we have a class about kind of how your body changes as you age. I think a lot of times we think about like puberty, that's when your body changes, and then like that's it. But really, our bodies are changing so much throughout our whole lives. So really thinking about sexuality education as a lifelong learning opportunity, not just like a, I always think about this like, a lot of, like I remember in, when I was growing up, sex ed was like in fifth grade, you watched a movie about periods. And then in eighth grade, they like mentioned like, don't have sex. And like, that's it. And I was like, what if we taught like math that way? Like one day in fifth grade, we learned about math. And then like, that was it for the rest. Yeah. Like we would never do that. But obviously like sexuality affects our lives forever. So it seems like something we should maybe be paying a little more attention to in schools.
Yeah, maybe so, right?
Right.
For many reasons. So I'm wondering, you know, I think that it's interesting that you got involved in this, and I want to know, it sounds like you cover several ages, but what does sexual education really mean to you, and why does this look different teaching it to people with disabilities?
Yeah, thank you. That's a really good question. I think a lot of times when we hear the word, you know, sexual education, sex ed, we like to say sexuality education because I think it just sort of encompasses a whole lot of things. So I always think about it as sexuality education, like, really includes so many parts of our lives. So, yeah, yes, we talk about reproduction and genitals, but we also talk about sexual orientation, gender identity, healthy relationships, relationships you have with other people, relationships, the relationship you have to yourself, body image. It really covers such a huge part of who we are. And so when I think about sex education, it really needs to be like comprehensive. It needs to include like kind of all parts of your being, not just like, I think a lot of times historically, sex ed has been like, don't get pregnant, don't. It's like a lot of fear based and shame. Like, if you do this, it's bad, or if this happens, whatever you did was wrong. But really, like, it should be kind of a joyful thing. Like, we're celebrating, like, having positive relationships, teaching people how about consent, body image, how they feel about themselves in the world. And then also, it needs to be accessible. It needs to be accessible for everyone, so people of all abilities, and that it supports cross-sections of identity, that it isn't like, okay, you have a disability, but you, like, also might identify as LGBTQ. And there's so many ways that we can make it more comprehensive that includes people of all gender identities, sexual orientations, ability levels. And then just, it's so important that it's, that sexuality education is really non-shaming, non-reactive, and just supportive for everyone. And the piece about working with people with disabilities kind of came out of, why we do the work that we do. We think a lot, like right now, in the last couple of years, there's been a lot of talk around, the Me Too movement and kind of around sexual assault, sexual abuse, like really heavy, hard topics for people to kind of grapple with. And there was a study done in 2017 by the Justice Department that found that people with intellectual and developmental disabilities were sexually assaulted at a rate of 7 times higher than their peers. And also during the study, they found that of the people who had experienced sexual assault, over half of them had been sexually assaulted more than 10 times, so 10 or more times. So when we think about our people with disabilities or people who are in special education, it's a huge, like, just safety issue, and something that I don't think has been talked about very much until very recently. And even now, I feel like it's kind of, people are kind of coming out and saying, like, hey, like, this is not okay. Like, everyone deserves to be able to have healthy and safe relationships, and that it doesn't matter, like, what your ability or disability is, that everyone deserves that. And so, yeah, that was kind of the, that's kind of our motivating factor. And while we, like, have two pieces with that is, like, that is a huge motivator for us. Like, we want to provide accessible, equitable sexuality education that helps people live safer lives. And then we also want to, like, really bring in the excitement and enthusiasm around, like, proactive education, and that sexuality should be something that we celebrate and that could be really positive. So, yeah.
We're speaking with Leah Bauman-Smith. Leah is from Mad Hatter Wellness, and we are talking about sexuality and disabilities. I want to remind people that there could be some content-sensitive content, age-sensitive content in this show, so be aware if you have young listeners. Leah, you know, that... the statistic you gave me always strikes me as just mortifying, because you're depending on, when you have a child with a disability, any disability, that you think that people will be more cautious, more caring. Mm-hmm. They're already more discriminating. We know that. But you would think that, you know, they would be more careful. There's teachers and caregivers and whomever else, but to have this statistic tells me that something clearly is going wrong. And what I don't understand is, how is it that that's such a high statistic? What happens? Where does the slip happen?
Yeah. So I think there's kind of a number of factors about why people with intellectual and developmental disabilities are more vulnerable to assault, and kind of a few different. So one is just kind of societal attitudes and beliefs around sexuality. I think that it's a topic where people are like, oh, no, my kid or my student or my whoever the person is that you're working with, They don't have sex. That's not like a risk factor for them. We don't have to worry about that topic. I think also people are really isolated a lot of times. So if you are someone who doesn't have a lot of friends or doesn't have a lot of access to other people to kind of talk to, that, you're more vulnerable to having someone kind of prey upon you if you are more isolated. Another thing is just kind of that people with disabilities or with intellectual and cognitive disabilities might not always be believed when they tell someone that something happened. I think also, I don't remember where the statistic came from, but it's something that we share a lot in trainings that we do, that only 9% of sexual assaults occur from strangers for people with intellectual and cognitive disabilities. So it isn't kind of that stranger danger, someone's out there to get you. Most often it's a family member or caregiver or someone who's being paid to kind of help take care of you. So a PCA, group home support staff. So that's really hard because it's someone that you are relying on and that's paid to care for you. I think there's a few other kind of things, like someone who maybe is higher need, who needs help with, say, like toileting or getting dressed. That can be really hard to kind of know when a touch is a necessary touch versus an exploitative touch. And so there kind of becomes this like learned dependence or kind of learned compliance. It's like, oh, well, this person is paid to take care of me, so they're doing what they're supposed to do. And so maybe they don't feel like they might feel kind of icky or like, oh, I don't think this, I'm not sure. It might not feel good to them, but the person might not know how to tell or who to tell. And so I think that I think people who are more vulnerable just have more access points. Like they have people who are, like lots of people who are paid to sort of care for them, and then that increases their risk of vulnerability.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of misperceptions with people about sex and disabilities. Mm-hmm. You mentioned one earlier that people with disabilities don't have sex.
Yeah,
which is right? Totally not true.
Yeah,
I think it's there are obviously some disabilities that seem to be accepted a little more, the idea, but I think that there's still that whole misperception. And I wonder if one of the misperceptions is as well is if they get abused, they won't tell.
Yeah. Yep. Right. Yeah, that was another. I think that there was another study. I always feel bad just like saying there's a study, but this is a thing that we share in our presentations a lot when we're talking to teachers and parents, that like 3% of assaults are reported. I don't know like where that number comes from, and so there's really low reporting, and because of I think. Maybe people aren't going to believe someone, or just like if you're nonverbal, like how do you tell somebody? Or if you have a communication disorder, how do you share this information with someone else who cares about you, who can help you? Or maybe you don't know what's wrong. Like if someone's always kind of helping you go to the bathroom or touching you, you like might not know. And so I think that there's a lot of ways that, yeah, it's like vastly underreported that it's happening.
So I understand you teach sexual education to a wide variety of ages. Is high school your main age, or what tends to be?
Yeah, so high school is my favorite age. I don't get to do that as much as I used to. I wish I was teaching more in high school. So kind of how we operate, a lot of schools, I think I know it's over 100. It might be over 150 schools and special education programs in the state. Like have our curriculum and are teaching sexuality education to their students. So usually when we're doing work with high schools, we're working with the teachers to kind of train them in this curriculum. And then we also have a grant through DHS to provide sexuality education to adults in group homes and in jobs like. employment like RISE or some of those employment programs, because we found that like we can't, a lot of adults didn't ever get any sexuality education. And so most of the classes I'm currently teaching right now are with adults, so over 21. I am teaching one right now that's kind of a high school transition age, like 16 to 21. But yeah, so the kind of the weekly classes I teach right now are more for adults.
You say high school is your favorite age. Why is that? Is there, do you feel like you're more free to ask things, or what is it?
I like really appreciate like how honest high school students are. Like they do not care about your feelings. And I just like kind of, I'm not all that, was like a vast generalization, but I just really appreciate how honest and funny they are. And just, yeah, I feel like also I will say, so as someone who's, I've have taught a wide range of ability levels, behavior, kind of a little bit of everything and specialized. And I found that even my students with like the highest behavioral needs, the ones that are going to, you know, say the F word to me 1 minute, as soon as I'm like, hey, we're going to do our lesson on sexuality education, like suddenly everyone is like, yes, I'm going to listen to everything you have to say. I'm going to be like, you know, super engaged and involved. And I think that young people just really crave this information. I work a lot with students who I've usually worked with older high school students, and a lot of times I'd be teaching them and they'd be like, this is the first time anyone's talked to me about this. And, you know, they're like 17, 18. So they've, a lot of them have already been through puberty, and they're like, oh my goodness, I wish someone would have told me about this while it was happening. Like, think about how scary that would be if you like didn't know what a period was and then you woke up and had your period. Like, that's really scary if you don't know kind of why and how that's happening. Or go ahead, Terry.
We talked earlier about how you discussed about how sometimes cognitive and people with intellectual disabilities tend to be pulled out of some of these classes and offered something else, such as reading time or whatever that might be. So why is this? And do you think that that's right? Or what do you think should happen there?
Yeah, it's definitely a complex situation. So one is that currently, like, Minnesota is not one of the states that requires sexuality education. So they do require health. And so a lot of times, and so the, but then the school district kind of gets to decide what's taught. And so I think a lot of schools include sex education, but some just don't. And then, I think that kind of along those same lines of like people thinking like, oh, people with disabilities or with cognitive or intellectual disabilities, they're not going to have sex, so they don't need to be in this class. And so that might be a time when they get pulled out of the class to do like reading support or meet with the speech therapist, and which like I always say that, and by the way, I also think reading is very important. But I think that a lot of times, and also I think parents too, they might be like, you know, I don't want my kid to be in that class. Like, they're not going to have sex, or that's not something that they're ready for yet. But I always want to be like, your kid is like, they're still going to go through puberty, whether they are ready for it or you are ready for it or not. Like, it just happens. It doesn't matter what, you know, ability or disability they have. Like, so they need that information. And I think there's sort of also, special education is tricky because you want to include students as much as possible. So I think a lot of schools take that sort of like equality approach. Like, oh, everyone is going to go to the same class about menstruation and how babies are made, and everyone will get the same information. So, but then you think about like, is that really equitable sex education? Like, are the people who have cognitive or intellectual disabilities, are they understanding the material?
Right.
Is the material, is it like, are you going at a pace where they're able to kind of keep up and know what you're talking about? Is there someone kind of reteaching the topics to them so that information sticks? Is it like, are you Yeah, are you providing accommodations for their learning or modifications for kind of how they get that information? And so I think that that is rarely happening. I do think that I'm a big fan of like including people whenever possible. I also think that this information is really important. And so having, you know, a smaller class or having a group where you are able to teach sexuality education in a way that is accessible to everyone is really important.
So when you're doing workshops or teaching like the teachers, mm-hmm. what kind of topics are you talking with them about? Like how are you teaching them to address the different topics that you need them to address or that you yeah. think they should address?
Yes. So that's one of the tricky parts of being about being a special education teacher that they don't always tell you is that you will teach everything. So you'll be teaching math, science, social studies, and you'll probably teach sex ed too, whether you want to or not. It's going to come up in your classrooms. And so we always we train the teachers in sort of like how to use our curriculum. Just we go through the curriculum is like very straightforward and with, you know, myself and Katie and Anna, our third colleague, she was a English language learner teacher. Katie and I are both special education teachers, so we feel like, and we've gotten a lot of good feedback, that it's very tailored to special education teachers. But then we really focus on, during our teacher trainings, sort of how to respond to questions. So a lot of, like, it's great if you can have a, like, separate you know, sexuality education class, but a lot of times these topics just sort of come up naturally, especially in special education classrooms. Like you might be teaching math and someone, you know, raises their hand and is like, how do you get pregnant? And you're like, what? I'm talking about math. You sort of just have to be ready for this to come up at any time.
All right.
And so we really encourage teachers to kind of sort of practice responding to those questions. So one thing we really encourage is to always say, that's a great question. Thanks for asking that. Like, even if it's like the most outlandish question you've ever heard, and you're like, oh my goodness, how am I going to answer this? A lot of times students are asking a question because they want to know if they're normal, or they want to know sort of like, they want information and you're a trusted adult. So making sure they feel like validated about their question. And then one thing that we encourage teachers to do is try to kind of, if you can, figure out like why they're asking that question.
Right.
Which can be tricky. And it's nice if you like know your students really well, because there are definitely some students who are going to try to do that like gotcha question. Like,
yes.
Make your teacher blush. And
yep.
I feel like that definitely happens. But then sometimes like, they might really just be asking you that question because they don't know, or they heard something from their siblings, or they, you know, saw something on a TV show and they want to know if it's real or if it's, you know. And so I always encourage teachers just like answer the like whatever factual part of the question. Katie, my boss, had a teacher, or someone asked her once if aliens go through puberty. And she was like, well, all living beings go through some changes in their lives at some point, so probably. And so just kind of thinking about how questions might be funny, but they also might just be, because the students are wondering, or because, so answering things as factually as possible. And we always tell teachers, like, it's also okay if you don't know the answer. And just to say that, to be like, you know what, I'm not sure about that question, but I will find out and get back to you. So we always say, like, make sure you get back to your students. Otherwise, they're going to be, like, Googling that question. You just want to kind of avoid Google and the Internet being your main source of sexuality education.
Yeah.
If possible. And then we always talk about just really trying to avoid value statements. A lot of times, students are kind of asking questions based on like values that maybe their parents have or their family has. And that can be a little bit tricky when you're an educator, because you don't want to be like, your parents wrong.
Right.
That would open up a whole can of worms. So we do a lot of, some people believe that, you know, touching your private parts in your own room is safe and healthy. Like other people believe that is not a healthy practice. Like, and so, but yeah, it's tricky because I'm terrible at that. I'm terrible at like keeping my values out of conversations about sexuality education. But we, you know, as a teacher, and then avoiding personal stories, that can be really hard. Especially when you're a special education teacher, a lot of times you have students for maybe multiple years and they get to know you. They know a lot about you. And so a lot of times students want to know, like, you know, how old were you when you had sex the first time is a question I get all the time. Like, and so then you have to be like, you know, that's a, some people, you know, that's a question. That's, everyone's different. You can decide to have sex when you feel like you're ready. And then kind of we'll have like a, here are some things that maybe you should think about before you have sex. But trying to avoid some of those. Yeah, it's hard. Students really want to, they want to know about your personal life. And then another thing that we really work with teachers on is responding to sexual behaviors. And so in special education, there are, every time we do a teacher training, someone is like, so how do I get my students to not touch themselves in class? And we're like, yep, every, like, that is a very normal question. Because there's so many different reasons why people might touch themselves in class. It could just be like, and usually it's not because they're trying to be gross or trying to freak anyone out, but it is a lot of times like a body's response to stress or anxiety, or they're just exploring. It's a new feeling. It's exciting. And if, you know, you have lower cognition or struggle with intellectual disabilities, you might not know that it's inappropriate. And so we teach a lot about sort of that, how to respond in like a non-reactive, non-shaming, like you have to be calm, also assertive. You know, if someone, you're on a field trip and someone pulls their pants down, you got to get those pants back up, you know, you got to get them to pull their pants back up. So you sometimes you have to kind of think quickly and think on your toes, but being as like, oh, we don't pull our pants down in public, you need to pull those back up, or that's actually illegal, you need to pull your pants up. But being really, not being like, oh my goodness, like, why are you doing that? Or trying to, you know, you don't ever want your student to feel bad for a behavior that they're, that they're exhibiting. I think, too, though, sometimes it's hard, like when you're a teacher and something kind of surprising happens and you're like, okay, I got to fix my face so I'm not like, oh my goodness. You know, internally you might be kind of panicking, like, what's happening? So being able to stay really calm and then also just remembering that, like, even in, like, obviously, like, in the moment, take care of the situation. And then remember that, like, when you're a teacher, like, you have a team of people who can help you. So if this is a situation that needs to be addressed, obviously, like, with the person, with your student, but also, like, talking to their parents, talking to your school social worker, your school administrators, like, really, you don't have to, like, figure all this out yourself. But, yeah, so just, I think, like, staying calm and non-reactive and non-shaming is like this. Yeah, that's kind of the most important thing.
We're speaking with Leah Bauman-Smith, who is from Mad Hatter Wellness. Leah is talking to us about sexual education, sex ed for all abilities. And I want to remind you that if you're just tuning in, what took you so long? But if you are, that there may be some sensitive content for younger listeners. So be aware of that. So, Leah, a couple things. You touched on something about, you know, parents can have different rules and being sensitive to them. And some of times I can't even, it baffles me how parents think, how they think sometimes. But that being said, my parents never talked to me about sex. It was just... I don't know what it was assumed, honestly. And I can imagine that if you have more profound disabilities or, you know, other types of disabilities where they're unsure of what you might understand or not understand, that they'd be more apt not to speak about sex. So how do you deal with that, and how do you address things with the parents? Because I'm sure then if you come in, the parents think, whoa, 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 what are you telling my child? So how does that work?
Yeah. Yes. I would say that that is can be one of the trickier parts of my job right now. Sometimes. I think that in high school it's nice because like if it's a, if you're in, you know, or not even just high school, if you're in the school system, there's kind of already like a, usually send home a letter, like the teacher would send home a letter saying, here's, you know, the curriculum we're going to use, here are the topics we're going to cover. You can opt in or opt out. And some schools do that. And then other schools might just say like, hey, we're teaching this. Like, let us know what questions you have. And then other times, so kind of our approach has been when we are working with people that we try to include parents as much as possible because, you know, like they're, like, ultimately they're going to be the ones who are educating their child the longest. And so if they can really be on board with this, it can be really helpful. So we do some parent classes where parents can kind of learn about the curriculum or learn about the work that we do. And then we have some resources online that parents can purchase. We have like a family discussion guide where it has different activities and questions and kind of facilitated. It's hard when you're a parent just to be like, oh, when am I just going to like sit down and talk to you about this? Like it can be tricky. So if you have some extra tools, we have like a little card deck called an Empower Me card deck where parents can, there's different topics and ideas on one side and then there's like discussion questions on the other side. Mm-hmm. And one of the ways that we really can kind of connect with parents who might be feeling a little bit anxious about this is a lot of times like our first three or four classes are really focused on healthy relationships, boundaries, safety, private versus public behaviors. And I think that most, like, usually parents are on board with those topics. Like, they, like, regardless of your child's abilities or disabilities, they want, like, parents want their kids to have healthy relationships, to be able to set boundaries, to kind of know what's appropriate to do in public versus what can you do in private. Personal safety, like, those are all things that most parents, I think all the ones I've met have been pretty on board with those.
Right.
And so that's a nice, so when we talk, I think, like I mentioned earlier, like sometimes people hear the word sexuality and then they're like, they're going to just talk about genitals and pregnancy and, you know, and like, yeah, we will mention those things and, you know, in depth and talk about them. But we've also had some parents that are like, you know, can my child, can they come to these classes when you talk about these, you know, healthy relationships, safety, can those be the classes that they attend? And like, we're very flexible in, like, we'll always, you know, like, we'll push it back a little bit, you know, with parents and be like, here, you know, like, here's why all of this is important. But we also want to, like, really meet people where they're at. Like, yes, if you're, you know, kid, or if your child can get information on boundaries and personal safety, like, those, that's going to be a huge, that's huge for them. And so, like, we really want to work with parents to make sure that they are also feeling supported too, because I think we think about, like, sexuality education can bring up so many feelings for everyone, like, not just the people who are in the class, so, like, the teachers, the parents, like, there can be a lot of trauma or a lot of feelings around this topic. And so as much as we can also support the parents to be like, you know, here are some resources. Here's how we can help you. And I think that that can be really powerful.
I'd like to touch on something I saw on your website on, specifically on boundaries, and where you showed when somebody wants to touch somebody or hug somebody, and you were showing, you know, different ways that they could approach that. One of the things that occurs to me that if somebody who has a vision disability along with these cognitive disabilities, they lose some of those signals. And and as well, maybe with autism even. So like they wouldn't necessarily see some of the facial signals or notice some of the facial signals. So what do you do with that when you have multiple disabilities?
Yeah.
Some of those cues, I would think, need to be changed. You would have to switch what you would teach.
Yeah, yes, definitely. So there's, there's kind of a lot with that. So kind of a two-pronged approach, I would say. So I recently worked with someone who had a vision impairment, and they would talk a lot about they kind of like would touch someone to kind of know who it was that, who they were talking to. They also had an intellectual disability. And so they would say like, well, but they were really good at advocating for themselves. And so they would tell that to the group, like before we'd start class, they would say like, oh, I am vision impaired. I might like, you know, touch your hand or touch your arm to see who you are. And then kind of people could then respond. And I felt like that was a really positive way. So people weren't feeling like, oh, this person just keeps touching me. Like they kind of knew why. And I think that was really important. So we do a lot of work too with like group home staff or job sites to also really train the staff and then also the other people in that community. So if we know that someone is vision impaired and might need touch as a way to, you know, navigate the space, that is, that everyone's aware of that and they know that that's a situation. Yes, and then we also have, so for people who are maybe nonverbal or who have communication disorders, we have a couple different, so we have things like voice to text or voice activated, so they can just push like a yes or a no.
Right.
Or we have little cards that maybe are on someone's wheelchair where they can look at like with their eyes if they have trouble with movement and speech, they can use their eyes to look at the yes or the no card. And so you just have to pay really close attention. I think a lot of the staff that we've worked with has been awesome about that and like trains their staff on how to kind of, because giving consent and asking for consent isn't always just as simple as like a yes or no,
right.
Because of lots of different ability levels. And we always talk about how consent is actually a three-step process. So you have to ask someone and then you actually have to listen to how they respond. And then you have to respect that decision. And that can get really hard. Especially when you're working closely with someone, maybe you're their PCA or you're their job coach and like you probably really care about them. And so, you know, you might want to give them hugs or you might want to, but just making sure to always model that, like asking, listening to how they respond and then respecting, that. And then we also teach a lot about like rejection. So how do you handle it if you ask for consent and they say no, like, what do you do? Because that's, can be kind of a hard feeling. So processing that's really normal. Rejection is like a super normal part of life and working on those skills too. And then also like, what do you do if someone says yes? Like if you ask someone if they want to kiss and they want to kiss you, like that can also be kind of scary and overwhelming too. So
yes.
Being able to kind of respond to consent and however it happens. But yeah, it is I think a lot of times, especially now during the Me Too movement, the word consent is used a lot, which I'm like very excited about. But I do wish that there was a little more kind of nuance about it, that people with communication disorders, people with vision impairments, people with intellectual disabilities might give consent in different ways.
I think consent is used a lot, but I also think it's misused a lot.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you would talk about a little bit about, you kind of talked about the whole my body is mine, you know, I'm sure good touch, bad touch. But, and you did refer to this a little bit. When you have a cognitive disability or something, let's say you're in a wheelchair and or maybe you're a para or a quad even, you really depend on whomever is assisting you to do a lot. And they're doing a lot with your body as bathing and assisting. Maybe they're doing catheters. Maybe they may be doing a number of things. So how do you teach what is over the line?
Yeah. Yep. Yes, that is really tricky. And I think another one of the reasons why people might be more vulnerable to assault is because sometimes that line isn't as clear. So we talk a lot about kind of exploitative touch versus necessary touch. And we always, like, as much as possible, like giving people choice. And I know that that doesn't always happen. Like we know group homes are super short staffed. We know that people are doing a million things all at once, but as much as possible, if you can really be respectful about like, you know, someone is going to help you use the bathroom, who do you want to help you? And then give them, you know, staff A or staff B. Or someone's going to help you get dressed. Do you want us to, you know, wait until, or do you want to put on your pajamas before you watch a movie or after you watch a movie? Do you want to, like, giving as much choice in the situation as you can, which I know is not always easy, but if you can create any way that that person has some autonomy or has some decision-making about their body, I think can be really powerful. To be like, I'm like, yes, I need someone to help me use the bathroom, but I get to decide, you know, when that happens or who that person is. I think a lot of times that can kind of, yeah, help with that self-advocacy and self-determination pieces that we want people to really develop. But yeah, it is, I think too, that's another thing that we talk a lot about with teachers and parents is like teaching about like what exploitation is, like what is sexual assault, what is sexual harassment, how to recognize in your body if something is happening that you're uncomfortable with, which can be really hard. Like I'm in my, I'll say mid-30s, maybe closer to late-30s, but, and I still would be like, oh, I was uncomfortable with that, you know, like, I, like 10 minutes after it happened, and I'm like, oh, wait a minute, I want to go back and be like, no. Right. And so kind of teaching those, like, you know, if your stomach is hurting or if, and then the other piece, or, you know, if you get nervous around someone or if it's someone that you just, like, don't really want to be around, and that doesn't necessarily mean that they, you know, hurt you or sexually assaulted you, but it might just mean, like, yeah, you're not comfortable around them. And then on the flip side of that, we talk a lot with teachers and parents of kind of how to recognize sexual assault. Excuse me. If it kind of changes in your student or your child's behavior. So a lot of times, if someone has experienced sexual assault, they maybe are cognitively delayed or have communication disorders or developmental delays, that they there might be a change in their behavior. And it doesn't always mean they've been sexually assaulted. It could just mean they had a medication change or they're going through puberty or they have a crush on somebody and they're acting really awkward about it. Yeah. But it can also mean that something happened that they didn't like or that they didn't, that didn't feel good to them. So any changes in, if someone's like nonverbal, if they kind of repeat phrases or words or, sounds, or if they kind of make new sounds, or if they can, if they are verbal and they complain of more stomach aches or more headaches, or if they kind of lose interest in maybe activities that they used to like, or they don't want to go somewhere that they used to be really excited about going to. And again, that doesn't necessarily mean that they were sexually assaulted, but it can mean that something happened. And so as their caregiver or parent or teacher, it's important to just recognize that those signs could mean that something happened and to follow up with either that person.
How about something that you went by in regards to having a crush on somebody. Obviously, when you get more intimate and personal relationships, you know, you go from boyfriend to girlfriend to, you might have several, or, you know, you may be the kind that likes to, you know, just date lightly, or you may be the kind that wants to get into some pretty heavy dating. And that whole thing about the layers of relationship. Can you address that and how you teach to that?
Yeah. So I am a huge fan of having crushes. My coworker Anna and I always talk about how we both want to have a crush on someone everywhere we go. So we're like very open to that idea. But on a more serious note, we do, we talk a lot about in our healthy relationship lesson about kind of the different categories of relationships we have in our lives. So our family members, our professional relationships, our friends, our romantic partners. And that's actually one of the sticking points. A lot of times romantic partner, has to be someone who also agrees that you are in a romantic partnership. So crushes can be, we don't really have a lot of control over who we have a crush on. Mm. You know, you might walk by someone and be like, oh, hey, they're really cute, but, you know, you might never see them again. Or it might
right.
be, it could be, and sometimes crushes aren't, like, they're on people that you wouldn't, it wouldn't be appropriate to have a relationship with. So it could be like your, you know, college professor or your boss or someone that you, you know, that you never would have a relationship with them. It just might be you like notice that feeling of a crush inside you. And so we talk a lot about sort of how you behave. And then just like really clear about like a romantic relationship. Yeah. So you can have romantic relationships with one or more people, but everyone needs to be aware of the romantic relationship. And then if you have multiple, that everyone needs to be aware that you have multiple relationships too. So it is pretty fun though. We get a lot of great answers. Like when we say like, oh, write down, you know, like, and also like you don't have to have a romantic relationship. Like that's really normal and healthy and fine too. And so many people though will write like Taylor Swift and we're like, does she know you exist? And they're like, no, but I'm pretty sure we're in love. And I'm like, well, you're not. But nice try. And we never want to, like, make someone feel bad about that. But we're just like, oh, Taylor Swift doesn't know you exist. So you're, and again, would she say that you're her romantic relationship? And then they're like, oh, no. Or some of them are like, yes, definitely.
Oh, yeah.
So there is a lot of kind of nuance when talking about relationships and about how relationships change. Like someone might be a friend, then they might become a crush, and then they might become a romantic relationship, or they might not, but that they're that relationships change, and who is in your friend and on your friend list one day might be not there the next day. So yeah, kind of figuring out all those different relationships
I want to
that we have can
briefly
be tricky.
On something that it's probably not a brief topic, but when I was growing up, I knew several people with some pretty multiple, you know, heavy disabilities, and the whole topic of masturbation came up, and mm-hmm. some of these kids or, you know, people at the time may or may not ever get into a relationship, but they still had the same, you know, the same things that happen to everyone, the
mm-hmm.
same hormones, the same everything. So how do you address, you know, especially the parents and whatnot, because parents thinking, well, I did it, but of course my kid shouldn't want to do that. She's got, you know, whatever.
Right.
So how do you address that, and is it more acceptable now than it used to be? Because that was really the debated topic. Should you teach them to do that? Or should you discourage it?
Yeah, I mean, I say like yes. I think it's you know, very healthy behavior. We talk a lot about kind of private versus public behaviors is one of our big lessons, mm-hmm. and talking about if you are going to do private behaviors like catching your genitals, masturbating, that needs to be done somewhere where you're by yourself, no one can see you, no one can hear you. So basically, you know, your bedroom or your bathroom. And then talking about, like, some people might share a bedroom, so you need to, like, make a plan with your roommate when you get to have private time. And we actually had a meeting this morning with some teachers who, some sexuality educators who were saying right now is really a hard time because people are so isolated with their families.
Yes,
and so maybe they never, right? So maybe the topic of masturbation hadn't come up before, and now suddenly, you know, if you're back sharing a room with your brother, or if you're staying with your parents and you haven't lived with them for a long time, or, I think that kind of advocating for privacy is definitely something that we teach the people that we're working with. And then also, like doing a lot of lessons around, like, when is it appropriate? So, and then we do really try to clarify too, like it is illegal to masturbate in public, or it
that's
is
important.
Right,
we can't talk about monetary stuff, but this is a great topic. I could have gone on. Can you tell people how they can reach you and whatnot?
Yes, yeah. So we have, so Mad Hatter Wellness has a website, and then we actually have a website for just specifically for sexuality for all abilities. So it's just sexualityforallabilities.com. And that has all of our resources. We have a ton of resources on there that we share. And then you can sign up for our newsletter, and we send that out a little more right now, just, you know, lots of people are at home kind of, you know, needing resources, needing information. And so we send out resources, all of our class information. You can sign up through, there's lots of like books, podcasts.
What's your website?
Sexualityforallabilities.com.
Okay. Well, Leah, thank you so much. I appreciate that you came on. I appreciate your time, and please stay well.
Yes, yes. Thank you so much for having me. It was really nice to be able to chat with you.
Thank you. This has been Disability and Progress.